have never sexually assaulted anyone. Not in high school, not in college, not ever.
Our economy is strong. Growth is running at a healthy clip. Unemployment is low. The number of people working is rising steadily, and wages are up. Inflation is low and stable. All of these are very good signs.
According to Reuters, a boost in the price of oil is keeping the S&P and the Dow near record highs.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Well, the Fed met this week. They raised interest rates for the third time this year, indicating another rate hike will be coming this year, making it four for this year. And there was a big show this week. Nobody was paying much attention to the Fed. They were watching the hearings in Washington on Supreme Court Justice nominee Kavanaugh, and the price of oil over $70 a barrel in West Texas, over $80 on Brent, and $90 on Oman oil. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up in Hour 1, my good friend Frank Barbera will be joining us as we take a look at the markets. Frank is cautious, but he still thinks this market has legs to head higher. He's also warning investors, hey, you're doing well in those FANG stocks, but you may want to take some profits. Just remember what happened to Facebook this year when it dropped nearly 20% in a single day. He's also taking a look at the topping process as we discuss what would he be looking at to tell him this market is getting close to the end. Also joining me on the program will be Greg Weldon. We're talking about the breakout of Treasury bond yields, and something's happened this year we have not seen in the last eight. Anytime the stock market gets in trouble, bonds are not rallying like they used to. Instead, yields are high, and we're over 3% on 10-year treasuries. He's also taking a look at something you may be interested in. Greg is watching the all-time low in silver and gold and natural gas, and that may be an upside undervalued area to invest in that nobody's paying attention. Of course, Ryan Poplava will be here as we take a look at what drove the markets this week. All of that coming up in Hour 1.
And this is Chris Prytower. In Hour 2, we'll be talking about $100 oil. More and more forecasts are now coming out calling for oil to move as high as $100. So in today's big picture, we cover the most recent events affecting the oil markets and the price of oil. And then we turn our attention to the Federal Reserve's recent FOMC meeting. We'll look at comments from Jay Powell and what higher interest rates mean for investors and those with mortgages, credit card balances, and auto loans. All of that coming up on The Big Picture. Well, let's turn to this week's wrap-up report with Ryan Poplava to discuss the catalysts and drivers that moved the financial markets this week. The S&P 500 was down this week. The 10-year Treasury was down, but oil is on the rise again with Brent above 80 and West Texas Intermediate above 70. Now, what else can you tell us about the week, Ryan?
Well, Chris, let me first off start by telling our listeners that we are considering some additions to the show, and I wanted to talk about those real quick. And we're looking to add, basically, Chris Poplava more on a weekly basis. We've been getting some really positive feedback about having him on the show more. We've listened, we've heard, and we're going to make it happen. So basically, he will be, in addition to Jim, in the big picture, he'll be talking about the big picture topics and more to kind of identify the trends, maybe the potential concerns that are out there, what we're viewing and where things might change our view on things, and then the strategies that we're putting in place to make this more relevant to our listener. And we've made some significant changes, Chris. As you know, many of those you've been helping us put together. And this summer, with our listeners being a big critical point to many of those changes, giving us a lot of feedback on a regular basis. And I encourage that to continue. We talk about that in our marketing meetings, getting an idea for what the kind of feedback is going on out there. And please, listeners, feel free to give me an email at ryan.poplava@financialsense.com anytime. Tell me what you like. Tell me what you don't like.
Well, I really appreciate that, Ryan. We should always strive to improve the show. This show is primarily about educating investors. And as Jim always says, an educated investor is a wise investor. So I'm really excited about Chris Poplava joining us on a more regular basis. Now, without further ado, what can you tell us about this week?
Well, Chris, the main events this week were the Federal Reserve Bank's meeting and policy statement for a quarter point hike and the removal of the accommodative language. The other was the news of the final budget deficit from Italy at 2.4%. These two were the main events, and markets have shifted as a result. But if I could start off on what happened last week, tying into some things we started seeing early in the week and all throughout this week was oil. You mentioned Brent being above 80, West Texas Intermediate above 70. What has led to this? And it's been, you know, the inventories, which we've discussed back and forth, some drawdowns there in the past weeks. I think there was a build this week. But there were some comments from OPEC that they are comfortable with $80 Brent oil, and that they would only increase output if customers demanded it. Now, this came after there were stories last week, late in the week, that they would support a 500,000 barrel per day expansion. Now, India plans to cut their imports from Iran by, I think we're at 375 million barrels per day at the end of August, down to zero. And that will happen by the end of November. And I read recently that the EIA report this week, which said refiners are at 90% capacity, they're full bore, and we're seeing prices rise. So this is some really interesting developments. I mean, Energy Secretary Rick Perry has said this week there are no plans to tap into that strategic reserve, saying basically that if he did, it would really only have a minor, maybe a short-term impact. So we're starting to see analysts are upgrading their price objective for oil, some to triple digits again, and energy stocks have done well this past couple of weeks, so I thought maybe we should talk about that as well. But you're right, the Federal Reserve Bank meeting, that was primarily the main event this week, as was that deficit number finally out of Italy. We've been talking about for a month now, right?
Yeah, it's been about a month, and we should probably begin to expect to see oil prices affecting headline inflation numbers across the globe as prices rise on top of full employment here. We've got tariffs, tighter supplies like Intel, which was mentioned on Friday. But let's get back to the two main events this week. What was the market reaction to Fed policy? Because it was largely what the consensus estimated, right?
Right. So the Fed did raise a quarter point as expected. I think we had like a 95% chance of that happening last week when we were looking at the Fed futures. The dot plot, which did come out this quarter, was pointing towards 12 out of 16, expecting that we'll see a hike in December. So we should expect to see Fed futures very high on that going forward. They also inched higher as far as the dot plot on where officials believe the long-term rate will be for rates, and they notched it higher up to 3% from 2.9. But Powell said the neutral rate may be underestimated, which was one of those hawkish comments that he did make at the press conference. Now, the takeaway overall with the removal of the accommodative language was a dovish consensus that we may be nearing a rate plateau in the next year after maybe another four hikes, then maybe a pause. That's where it's interesting how the market interpreted this data, and that caused spreads to narrow and financial stocks to fall on the S&P financial sector down. It was down around 1.5% on Wednesday. Now, the 2 to 10-year Treasury rate spread came down to 23 basis points, and it continues to be, as John Loeffler and I used to always put it, flatter than a pancake. And essentially, there's no change there, and that's what's really affecting those financials. Now, current Fed futures are only anticipating two hikes next year, going out to I'm looking at October. So there's a real disconnect right now between the Fed's projections and the market. Now, the charts on the financials look very troubling to me, Chris, and relative strength, that's the performance in financials versus the rest of the market, has been hitting fresh lows year to date this week. And I don't know if you recall, but Luis Yamada, when I interviewed her in August, had really hit it on the nose. She was not very confident in the financials, even though there was a near-term rally in the stocks. And I think that's because she was continuing to follow that relative strength down.
Well, Ryan, let's turn more to Italy, because I believe Jim will be spending a bulk of his time on the big picture talking about the Fed meeting and the press conference with Chairman Powell. And by the way, we'll be playing several key clips from that conference. But Ryan, what's the reaction at the end of the week to the Italian budget deficit of 2.4%? I mean, their market really took quite the hit. Are investors anticipating more of a fight to come now with the EU?
It's been an interesting development all week, as we heard from many officials throughout the week what the numbers might be as we got finally to Thursday. So it was a lot of back and forth, but it was relatively calm. There was a lot of estimates that were actually below 2%, and so that was shoring up a little bit of confidence. The biggest number that's relative to the agreement is the one Finance Minister Tria said he was comfortable with, which was between 1.4 and 1.6%. So at 2.4%, that's well above what he was comfortable with. The question right now is, does he decide to resign or will he agree with it and move forward? And there's been some rumors that he's agreed with it, but if he does resign, that could spell more uncertainty. So that's definitely something to continue to follow politically, maybe over the weekend if he puts his stamp of approval on it. Now, the Italian equities dipped back down to the August lows, down around 800 points. That's 3.7% on Friday. That was a big hit. And the Italian banks, who own a large chunk of the government's debt, took the brunt of that beating. Now, yields on their 10-year government bond are back up as well. In fact, on Friday, they were up 26 basis points to 3.14%. Couple the fact that the ECB's quantitative easing program is set to end at the end of this year, and supply now, given the deficit, is going to be larger than expected. Couple those two things together, and you can imagine what bond investors are thinking where rates will go. On the flip side, quantitative easing has not helped Italy from an economic standpoint, so it's still not off the ground. And so with the new party in town, both of them, their goal is to stimulate the economy through fiscal spending. Maybe this does work. It did work for us, right, in 2008-9. So here's the story now. 2.4% is still compliant and under that 3% guideline of GDP requirements, but the European Commission may feel that Italy is not taking its fiscal responsibilities seriously enough, and so they may step in and require that they go back and form a new budget. And if still they're not happy with wherever things are at along those lines, they could shift to sanctions. So outside the EU's response, the debt is likely to get downgraded now from Moody's and Standard & Poor's, given their previous assumptions heading into this agreement. They'll update their comments and ratings next month, so we'll see how lenient or maybe not they'll be. But the conversation could continue to be fluid in the weeks ahead. It has been a subject of our discussion, you and I, for the past month. It's not going away. You know, they would have liked to have seen a number below 2%. Overall, this wasn't, again, that 2% rate. So we'll just have to see where things go and where their path is to fiscal soundness. Maybe the fiscal stimulus helps. At the same time, the League and the Five Star Movement was voted in by a populist vote and to try and improve their economy. So, you know, you think about it from their perspective, cutting spending is not going to help.
You mentioned energy stocks have done well these past couple of weeks, and I know that the charts on the financials don't look very good, but overall, I appreciated hearing about the dovish consensus from the Fed. So even though they've removed the accommodative language, Ryan, I want you to know that we're always going to accommodate you here on the Financial Sense NewsHour, and we'll look forward to hearing your report next week as well. Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. That features interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's what you missed.
Usually, corporate debt relative to GDP makes highs at the bottom of the cycle when GDP is shrinking and everybody's tapping their credit lines. So today, corporate debt relative to GDP is extremely high. And what's interesting is that the amount of debt that has grown the fastest is actually basically just one notch above junk. And so you have companies that are today in the midst of an economic boom, just one notch above junk. If and when the economic cycle rolls over, such companies usually get downgraded to junk. As you downgrade them to junk, funds typically have to sell them. And then the question will be, of course, to whom? You might call your broker and sell my bonds, and the broker may very well say, well, to whom? And this is For me, that's perhaps one of my biggest concerns today.
Do you know the impact of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act to your personal finances? Are you a high-income earner, owner of multiple real estate holdings, or considering divorce? If you are, your taxes may be going up. Come to the Financial Sense Strategy and Wealth Preservation Conference by Jim Poplava and his special guest, Chris Hennessy, a tax lawyer and CPA, to explore what the new tax law will do to your finances. The conference will be held at the Hilton San Diego Hotel in Del Mar on October 27th. To learn more, go to www.financialsense.com for information on how you can register. That's www.financialsense.com. Seating is limited and going fast. Don't let filing your 2018 taxes give you a rude awakening. Be prepared now. Investment advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, a little bit of a rough patch for the markets this week, whether it was the president's speech at the UN, trials and shows in Washington, and of course, the Fed met this week and raised interest rates for the third time this year. A little nervousness in the market. Joining me on the program is my good friend Frank Barbera from the Gold Stock Technician. And Frank, as you're looking at the market, this market has gone up, but what we're seeing as this market goes up, increasingly, a good majority of the returns within the indexes are being powered by a handful of stocks. So as you look at the charts today, what are those charts telling you about where this market is headed?
Jim, I would say it's still too soon to count the bull out. It is a clearly this is a very elongated cycle. When you look at some of the big market cap leaders, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Google, the FANG, so to speak, it's very tempting to say they've had a huge run. It's time for them to pull back. However, you know, actually what I'm seeing is really the opposite right now. I keep an index, an unweighted index of sort of the FANGs plus a few other big market leaders, things like NVIDIA, you know, some of the glamour darlings of this cycle that have been so consistently pushing the market up. It's only an index of about eight to 10 stocks. And obviously, the names like Amazon and Apple are really going to swing that index. They're going to contribute a lot to the overall movement. What you find if you just sort of zero in on those glamour names is that they got very overbought, at least extreme overbought readings a couple of months ago. And what we've seen is actually very surprising. I've unwound those overbought readings and they've moved back down to relative oversold readings. In a bull market, take an indicator, for example, like RSI, which is a pretty well-known indicator, the relative strength index. Yeah, the normal parameters for overbought and oversold are 70, plus 70 and 30. And you're talking about an indicator that's normalized on a 0 to 100 scale. So the indicator can't move below 0, and it can't move above 100. It has to stay between those two numbers. And usually when it's below 30, you're talking about an oversold market or above 70. And this is very, very generic overbought. In a bull market, you tend to get this upward shift where bull markets go up and press overbought readings to even more extremes. You get readings in the 80s and 90s, and then oversold, instead of being 30, tends to elevate up into the low 40 area. So you get what's called the 80-40 rule for bull markets. And in bear markets, it's just the opposite. Bear markets push down and tend to hit deeper values of oversoldness. So you get readings in the 20s, and then overbought readings peak a lot lower in the 60s. So in the bear market, it's the RSI 20-60 rule. That works very nicely, by the way, with a nine-day RSI. If you look at the FANG index, and I'm sorry for that long-winded tutorial on RSI, but if you look at the FANG index and we take a medium-term RSI, they got all the way up into the high 80s, the mid 80s, and early this year in January 26, plus 84.2, and the index was at 432.8. And what we've seen as recently as August 17th was an oversold, a relative oversold reading at 39. And the index, instead of having given any ground back was actually net higher in price. It was at 502.7. And then we've been holding well above those lows ever since. And it looks like it's gearing up for another big run. So what I see, that's what's called a running correction. When you unwind an overbought excess and you hit a relative oversold, a shallow oversold, and you don't give anything back in price, that's a very big telltale sign that whatever the item is in question still wants to go up. And so in my work, I think we're actually getting set up for a blow-off move in these stocks, which could have anywhere between 25 and 50% of the upside still left in it. So we're going to have some real fireworks to finish off the bull market, sort of like what happened in gold in 1980 when gold doubled in 1 month, or in the NASDAQ in early 2000. I think if that's going to happen, it's going to happen pretty soon. But right now, I'd say that's where we're going, that this bull market is going to keep moving up. We may continue to see sectors fall apart, peel off and start moving down. And we may see internal measures like the advanced decline line, new highs and new lows, they may start to diverge. That's all typical of sort of a ninth inning environment. But I think this, I think the market may have another couple of months to go before we actually hit some kind of final high.
So, Frank, as we see these valuation extremes, I don't care if you're looking at Amazon, you're looking at Apple. I mean, these are great companies, but can you say, are these trillion-dollar companies the size of many countries' GDPs? You're also seeing in the bond market, you're seeing covenants go away on bond issues, the vast majority of bonds coming out are triple B rated. It's something that you always see towards the peak where people get a little bit more careless, lenders get a little bit more freer, bond covenants go away, the spreads between treasuries and higher risk bonds narrows. We're seeing all of that take place right now. The question is, bull markets can go longer than you and I expect, Frank, just as bear markets can drop faster than we expect.
That's exactly right, Jim. And this bull market, certainly it's one of the longest in history. That's another important point that should be made. When you look at very long bull markets, they tend to be followed by outside, deeper than average bear markets. So we are, 9 years into this bull cycle. You can really argue we haven't seen a healthy 20% dip since 2012. So it's stretching time, the history of time in terms of depth of correction. It's been a long time without seeing a 20% move. And that's usually a red flag, but it hasn't meant anything of late. And if you look at the weekly chart on the NASDAQ, on the S&P, you can actually draw a rising parallel channel from the highs back in 2011 across the highs in 2015. And we're outside that upper channel line. That's typical of a fifth wave blow off. And those can last a while. So I think we're in the late stages of the market. I think we're in the late stages of the economic cycle. So I think for most investors, the real practical takeaway is, it's a time you can be invested, but you have to be constantly watching over your money. If there's a substantial break from here, the next time we get one, that's probably going to be a warning shot. Markets tend to top with M-type top. Even if it's not a perfect M, you get a spike, you get a big break, and then you get a second retest of the high. So we haven't seen that yet, but I think that's sort of the path ahead. Sometimes that right side of an M can be a little higher or a little lower, but yeah, I think ultimately, we'll see something that shows up on the charts over the next couple of months that really identifies the final endpoint of this bull market with a classic bull market top. I don't think we've seen that yet. And I actually will be the first one to have been really surprised that this market has gone as long as it has. But at this point, I think that inflection point is ahead of us, probably sometime in October or November, as really the extreme part of it. I think that's where you'll get the high and the FANG stocks. And then once that turns, you'll probably see other asset classes like bonds, which have been out of favor for a long time, and physical precious metals, mining stocks coming back in. So I think for investors who are interested in other asset classes, there's benefits that will come from this inflection point, but I think we're early still and we're not there yet.
So, Frank, as you're looking at this market, you think it's peaking, but you still believe that there's some room left, so we could head higher and powered by some of the strong stocks you talked about, like the FANGs. But sooner or later, things start to roll over. What signs would you be looking for that would tell you we are getting to that point or close to that point? Is there anything specific that stands out or that you look for and watch to tell you the tide is turning?
Of course, Jim. And let me make one point really clear. I'm no fan. I like to sleep well at night. You know, when I put my head down on the pillow, I really like to nod off. And the last thing I would do at this point in time is buy any of those stocks. So this is no endorsement on my end for going out and buying Apple or Amazon or Google. I think they're all hideously overpriced. If I owned them, I actually probably wouldn't sleep well at night. But just looking at the charts look like they could have another run, but that's really dancing very close to the fire. And it's only suitable for people who have that mindset, you know, who won't be upset if they wake up one morning and things are just, you know, overnight down. Because that's the way, look at Facebook. Facebook was trending up for weeks and weeks and weeks, and then from one day literally to the next, without any warning, it dropped 20%. And so that's the risk you're playing with right now. It's really playing with fire. So I'm a much bigger advocate right now of protecting capital, you know, being in short duration bonds, earning some interest, and waiting for, you know, really the high quality opportunities that are bound to come. That's kind of why I like the precious metals, because they're, gold is at a level where we've seen the biggest net short in years in terms of large speculators. Sentiment, I have a dollar weighted put call ratio that went to some of the most extreme readings ever. And a host of other technical indicators that I watch are telling me that gold is near a major bottom. So I think right now there's value there. And I love to buy value because I don't have to worry about it as much. So, and especially if you scale into it and space out your buying over time, a little dollar cost averaging can go a long way towards giving you a good night's sleep. Jim, I'm afraid I forgot the first part. It's the other part of your question, but you were the telltale signs. Telltale signs, I'm keeping my eye on the emerging markets. Problems tend to start at the periphery and work into the core. And so, you know, the Chinese, Hong Kong market, the APAC rim area. I think if we're going to continue to walk down this path with China, with trade tensions and escalating tariffs, that's going to start to affect the emerging markets even more over time. You might even see more instability, things like the Hong Kong dollar. I think that's an area to keep a close watch on. China has said officially that they won't devalue, but in the history of devaluations, governments saying that they won't devalue has been immediately what has happened before they devalue. So there's a long history of that, and I think you have to keep an eye on what's going on in the Pacific Rim, because right now that seems to be the hotbed, in a way emerging on a geopolitical basis as well, with all the tension in the South China Sea.
All right. Well, listen, Frank, as we close, if our listeners would like to get a hold of you or find out the work that you do at the Gold Stock Technician, tell them how they can easily do so, please.
Sure, Jim. I'm offering them, if they would like a two-month trial subscription, we'll give them a free two-month trial subscription. The email is Frank, FRANKB, as in boy, GSD, as in Gold Stock Technician, @AOL.com. All they have to do is drop me an email and we'll be happy to sign them up and keep them in the loop.
All right. Well, listen, Frank, thanks as always for coming on the program. All the best, sir. And we'll talk again.
Thank you, Jim. Stay well. Take care.
Our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense Insider. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
China is going to continue to slow, right? I mean, they can't keep up the double-digit rates of growth that we saw, I believe, peak in 2011. I think that's when we saw the Chinese economy see its peak rates of growth. At least we should expect them to continue slowing. Isn't that correct?
Chances are that the manufacturing sector will continue to weaken and the situation will definitely continue to deteriorate. And there, by the way, what we saw then is that manufacturers seeing definitely a deteriorating cash flow picture along with it, corporate health suffering, rushed to the banks. We saw something like an astonishing 2 out of 5 manufacturers borrowing this quarter, which is the highest we've recorded in almost 6 years, a little bit more than 6 years. Among those who borrowed, about half or so said that they actually increased the amount that they borrowed this quarter compared to last quarter. So something of a panic is certainly starting to become apparent in the manufacturing sector.
Well, the Fed met this week and they raised interest rates for the third time this year, indicating the possibility another one is coming as soon as December. What does interest rates mean? What is this going to mean for the markets, commodities in general? Joining me on the line is Greg Weldon from Weldon Live. And Greg, I want to go to something that you put out to your listeners, and that's the breakout in the 2-year Treasury yield. On the day we're speaking, it's close to 2.83, and it is rising. Let's talk about the implications for this and what this means going forward, especially now that the Fed is implying they're not done yet, and another one is coming in December.
Well, there's a couple ways that I think we need to look at this. And I think to do that, we need to backtrack, because understanding how we got here first is important. And it goes back to last September, almost this exact time of year, hurricane approaching Florida, everyone bugging out. I went to Biloxi, Mississippi for 9 days. And during that period, I wrote the piece. I forget what I even called it back then, to be honest with you, but it was actually published September 22nd of last year. And at the time, the 2-year note was 141. We said it was going to 265. And the reason was that Yellen had just come out at the September Fed meeting and said, we want to, they dropped normalization. And I always hated that phrase, all right? Normal. What? You can't define normal. I mean, normal is what normal is. And Forrest Gump saying, that's very appropriate, all right? Normal is zero sometimes, you know? So to the degree to which normal was a bad way to kind of, couch the terminology around what the Fed's goal was, when they shifted to the word neutral, which I had been saying for months, let's talk about neutral. Because they can get to a neutral policy. There's nothing normal about any of this that's going on now. And we could talk about that for 2 hours. But neutral gave us definition. And neutral gave us the inflation rate as the level to which you needed to get interest rates to be zero, which would at the very easiest be neutral, or really even at the very tightest be neutral. But so that was a pretty easy call, frankly, because at the time inflation had moved above 2. It had just peaked, I think, at 2.7 or 2.8 on CPI. They target PCE. PCE is above 2 here. Okay. I mean, CPI is 2.7. So when we start talking about when you move from 140 to 265, the idea was we're targeting 2.5 as a neutral rate. And the 2-year note would have some little vig above the Fed funds if Fed funds were to be neutral, and that would be about 15 basis points. Therefore, our 265 target. And man, if we didn't hit that almost bang on, I think the high, until more recently was 264.7, so it was right there. More recently now, the thought process was to go higher in the 2-year note yield would suggest that inflation was going higher, which would in turn force the Fed to chase inflation with policy to stay neutral, because neutral moves, and it moves with inflation. It's pretty simple. But this is a little different because inflation is not moving really. I mean, there is certainly scope for it to move higher. There's a lot of kind of inflation out there that the Fed can't do anything about in terms of supply chains and tariffs and some of the backlogs and, disruptions in some of the labor market, dynamics. So from that perspective, it's interesting to note that the CRB is actually down on a 6-month basis, down on a year-over-year basis, down on a 2-year basis. So outside of energy being a new high, so you don't really see it kind of in the commodities market per se. So all this is very interesting in terms of why is Powell insisting on continuing to theoretically push higher? And I would suggest it might just be a lot of puppeteering and verbalization and a way to get more vig when he knows he has to turn. We don't see that yet, but I'll tell you what, I think it's on the horizon. And if you look hard enough, I think you can see, you know, some distress in the consumer, some downturn in the economy. And to think you're going to reach what is now a 5% nominal GDP target for the Fed, their forecast, I don't see how that's feasible.
Fiscal policy and monetary policy work in conjunction. You come out of a recession, the government stimulates spending, the Fed lowers interest rates, or QE, as they did last time. This time, Greg, we're getting fiscal spending at the end of a business cycle at the time the Fed is moving in the opposite direction with raising interest rates. And I'm sure it's caught the president's eye, and he's already tweeted he's not too happy about rising rates. This is a real estate guy. He's made his fortune in real estate, and he knows what happens when you raise interest rates.
Well, I mean, we love Donald Trump's policies, but, you know, often we wish he would just keep his mouth closed because he is often his worst enemy. And, you know, I don't want to get too specific, but, you know, I just think Donald, to me, is not the most well-spoken guy to begin with. So he really ought to just, you know, really put the phone away, because it doesn't work in his favor. And he thinks it does. And particularly when you're attacking the Fed, who is going to, you know, to their deaths, you know, maintain their autonomy no matter what. So if he wants the Fed to stop hiking rates, he needs to close his mouth. That's the best way. I don't think it matters at the end of the day. And I think when you kind of, you know, come back around, you know, it really does. There's even more going on here, because also what has happened in not to as much fanfare in the last 24 hours, 36 hours, is what's happened in Europe. And Draghi's comments to the EU Parliament were very hawkish. And what's interesting about all that is you see for the first time the German two-year Schatzi yield on the rise. It's breaking out. And that is probably the biggest development this week in my mind. And frankly, that is something that probably squelches some of the rally in the dollar. But I think when you start to talk about a rise in global bond yields, that is, you know, maybe kind of almost where, you know, the fear always here is that central banks lose control of bond markets because of all the debt. This could be a problem. So these are also issues that, you know, let alone you talk about fiscal spending, A, it's not QE. It doesn't really add kind of the same kind of money that QE does. I mean, tax cuts is one thing, but that's money that was already there. You're taking it from the government. And in terms of public borrowing, I think you probably know this, Jim. I mean, over the first 9 months of the year, public borrowing is almost $1 trillion. That's, last year at this time, it was about $160 billion. This year, it's $800-something billion. It's completely unsustainable, you know, so that's a whole nother thing where, again, you know, the potentially losing control of the bond market. So I keep a real eye on the German Bund here, because, you know, the thought process around Germany, I mean, around the ECB raising rates at a time we see what's going on in Italy, what's going on in Spain. Spain's on the hook for Turkey. Spain's on the hook for Argentina. Spanish banks can't take the hit. You know, the ECB waited too long. You don't have any price movement to the upside in any of the European banks to give them a cushion. This is a real problem going forward. I mean, this is where I start to like gold, because then I start to see, you know, scenarios where it kind of is a flight to safety, and even bonds don't look good in a flight to safety. In that case, what does look good? It's not going to be the dollar. It's going to be gold.
And let's talk about that, because typically, Greg, up until we got to this year, if you saw a pullback in the market like we did in 2011, 15, 16, the beginning of this year, something changed. Typically, you had the risk on, the risk off trade. Something happened in the stock market. Investors would get nervous. Money would come out of the stock market. Traders would go into bonds, drive the yields down. That did not happen in February, and it's not happening now. So let's talk about that dynamic.
Well, I think you bring up a really, really good point, and I think it can be expanded to make a really big picture point, which is to simply go back to 2008 and what happened when the stock market, you know, started coming unglued then. Well, investors sold everything, including gold. And while gold outperformed by holding its value better, meaning it went down less than did stocks at the one point where gold was still going down, that was a function of the fact of what we mentioned earlier, man, gold was a heavily owned market back then. Well, we know that most recently you had the commitment of traders show us that gold had a speculative short position for the first time since 2001. You don't have that same scenario here where there's a ton of gold to be liquidated if the stock market gets whacked. So I think that sets us up here where it could potentially even be a short covering rally. That's the catalyst. You know, if the stock market gets hit, You know, we're kind of watching Italy and Spain as our kind of lead characters there. Certainly emerging markets remain very much under pressure. You know, that hasn't changed much, and we haven't talked much about that, but the number of currencies that are at or near record lows is lengthens pretty much, you know, every other week. So that's a whole nother issue. But in terms of the potential for a stock market hit, and we've talked about the passive investment in all the same stocks that are huge nominal single share prices with volume in terms of turnover that is virtually non-existent anymore because the shares are just priced too highly. Who's going to buy blocks of those shares when someone goes to sell them? Nobody. You know, a buyer's vacuum. And I think in turn, that would be definitely be a catalyst for gold because first, it would probably hurt the dollar. And more importantly, you don't have people long gold where they're going to liquidate everything to raise capital. They're going to look to move into gold because, like I said before, bonds are not going to be an option anymore. And how much harder does that make the central bank's jobs, theoretically, in trying to arrest some kind of seizing of the markets? Wow. I mean, this is where it gets really interesting for gold.
Yeah. The thing that really strikes me is not only treasuries are not acting as a safe haven, but also if you take a look at the price of commodities, and I want to move on to silver for a minute, because in Barron's last week, they pointed out for the fifth consecutive year in a row, silver has been running a deficit. It was 26 million ounces last year. But the thing that was really surprising, and let's talk about what this might imply, the U.S. Mint ran out of silver eagles. They're flying off the shelf. They're going to have to step up production. So you've got buyers coming in with silver down about 70% from its high, buying the bullion, the eagles, the mint runs out of it. I can't remember the last time that happened.
It's probably back in, if memory serves, and I could totally be wrong on this, but if memory serves, it was kind of like 2006, 2007. And I think you had the American Gold Eagle, and they sold out of that. And it was a very similar situation. And in fact, it was a precursor of exactly what happened. You know, in terms of, to me, silver is like, you know, always going to go the way of gold. And the gold-silver ratio actually reached like a 28-year high just a week or two ago. So to me, that means that silver is as cheap here as it's been against gold in three decades. Now, that makes it pretty attractive. The problem is technically it's cracked. On the other hand, it's held the 2016 low. So there's a lot of cross currents in here. We want to kind of be nibbling here, but I still think, you know, in there were some of the mining shares we can even talk about, frankly, because there, I think during the next phase, that's going to be an interesting play. We called that in 2016, our 16 for 16 year ahead in 2016 was all about the mining shares. And we picked a few, and one of them had like a 600% gain that year. It was the top performing silver miner. We're looking at that same type of setup here. We're looking to make those same kind of plays, you know, in the near term. Clearly, the Fed meeting now puts us back on our timeline just a little bit. I don't know what the catalyst is going to be. I really don't. But the fact of the matter is the playing field is more littered with mines than any time I've seen in the last decade. And, you know, ultimately you're going to step on one. So whatever the catalyst is, it's out there already, whether it be emerging markets or whether it be the U.S. budget. I mean, gosh, there's so many ways you can look at this in terms of Italy and Spain, in terms of emerging markets, South America. I mean, even the Russian, the former Soviet republics, you know, Kazakhstan. And I mean, some of these countries, you know, commodity producers, with currencies at or near record lows and back into a depreciation mode. So the writing's on the wall. How this plays out, we're not quite sure, but we want to be ready. It's why we do this every day. It's why we have passion for this every day, because we get up and we never know what we're going to find. And we just love, you know, connecting the dots and making this all make sense to where we can help people make money. And I think we're going to have a very fertile time for that in the near to medium term.
You know, this reminds me, Greg, of a comment or from Michael Lewis's book, The Big Short. And he said, it ain't what you don't know that kills you. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so. And that's the thing that I guess concerns me, and especially hearing the press conference yesterday with that first question, is you going to keep doing this? And at what point do you kill something? If I was telling you, Greg, let's take a flight on an airline, you're going to fly to New York, and you found out that the airline has a 90% track record of crashing their airplanes. 11 out of the last 12 recessions were preceded by Fed rate hikes. How confident would you be on getting on that airline?
Well, I think that you just, I mean, kind of raised a really, really good point, because you can see it, you can feel it, you can hear it, it's tangible. And that is, the constant comment that I hear, most recently very pronounced by the CEO of Target, that the consumer is the healthiest he's been in three decades. Powell said it yesterday. Consumer balance sheets are quote unquote fine. No, they're not. They're only fine as long as stocks hold up here, right? If stocks go down, the balance sheets get whacked and consumers still owe all the debt. We've talked about this how many umpteen times. When I hear that the consumer is as strong as ever, I say, you know what? You may look strong in the wrestling ring if you're in your prime as a wrestler, but guess what? You are so dosed with steroids that you can't see the internal organ damage. And to me, that's the consumer, because they've gone on a borrowing binge of unprecedented proportions since 2014. 38 straight months ending July of last year, where the 12-month rolling net change in consumer credit was above $200 billion every single month for more than 3 years. You're starting to see delinquencies rise, not in percentage of loans, but in the dollar amounts. It's the highest since 2007 and 8, and the second highest in history. You know, so I when you say that, I immediately think of the consumer, and this is the kind of thing. Well, they keep raising rates, until all of a sudden the consumer's on life support. And you wondered, how did we get here?
Well, we got there as they always get there, raising rates to the point they break something. This time it may be emerging markets, maybe the consumer, who knows. Greg, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work, and you do more detailed work than anybody I know in the business, tell them how they could do so.
Sure, they can come to our website, which is Weldon Online, Weldon Online.com, one word, WeldonOnline.com, and sign up for a free trial if you haven't had one before. And we do Weldon Live, and we do a live briefing. So one of those is published every day. Every sector we cover, which is stock index, bonds, currencies around the world, precious industrial metals, the energy, and the ags. We track the trades every day. We give you the stops. We do it all for you. And that's all in one price, one product. And I'll add real quickly, Jim, since we didn't get to talk about it, one of my really kind of favorite trades right here, especially since it's down today or was earlier, is natural gas. Because you have a big deficit in natural gas. You've had the pundits and the commercials expecting, because production's up so much year over year, double digits, that you would fill that gap from last year's big demand season, okay, in terms of these, you know, natural gas and storage. The injections have been running ahead of, you know, the five-year average, but not nearly enough because demand is so strong. You're looking at a 18 to 20% supply deficit relative to a year ago. You're looking at a 200 billion cubic feet deficit relative to the low of the last 5 years. And prices are right where they've been for the last 5 years, just under $3. To me, natural gas is a big surprise coming, you know, in the next 6 months. That's one we'll throw your customers just as a bonus.
Yeah, and to that, I would probably add silver, too, which is also at a supply deficit. Greg, as always, I appreciate you coming on the program. You have yourself a great weekend.
You too, Jim. My pleasure. Anytime.
Thanks, Greg.
We do thank you for listening to the second half of the Financial Sense News Hour. Be sure to stay tuned for Hour 2, The Big Picture, where we talk about $100 oil. Then, Jim Poplava and I will be discussing details impacting the price of oil. Then, Jim Poplava and I will be turning our attention to the Federal Reserve Chairman's comments at the FOMC meeting, discussing what higher interest rates mean for investors and consumers. So be sure to stay tuned for Hour 2, The Big Picture.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.